between now and the end of the year, with a little break in mid-November. Lord willing, we will be studying through this book. I wasn't planning to do this until about a month ago, when I sensed a pretty sudden and strong burden to preach the book of Job in this congregation. My burden is that our congregation right now needs a strong dose of the indescribable greatness of God, which is exactly what Job emphasizes. I'm also convinced that we should study Job right now because of the way that it complements Ecclesiastes, the book we just finished studying. Job and Ecclesiastes are a bit like fraternal twins. They both challenge whether living for God results in blessing. Does living for God result in blessings in your life? They challenge that idea. Both of these books are like twins in that they stress the importance of fearing God and the importance of living for God and respecting God, even when it leads to suffering and even when you can't understand what God is doing. I've said they're like fraternal twins. If you know fraternal twins, they're born at the same time, but they can look as dissimilar as brother and sister look. I must point out that as similar as Job and Ecclesiastes are, they're very different. It's been said that Ecclesiastes tells everyone life is all about God. Life is all about fearing God. But Ecclesiastes is written from the perspective of a man who had it all. While Job says, life is all about God. Life is all about fearing God. But it's from the perspective of a man who lost it all. I believe that right now, having just studied Ecclesiastes, we need God's word from the book of Job. So what is Job all about? Job is all about loss. It's all about suffering. It has been quite popular to say that Job is all about answering the big question, why does God allow suffering? Many of the most popular study Bibles in our day will suggest that the big question Job answers is, why does God allow suffering? There is one major problem with this view. If you've ever read the book of Job, it doesn't answer that question. God never answers Job's repeated question, why? Job asks, why is this happening to me? In like 20 chapters of this book, chapters 6 and 7, 9 and 10, 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, 19, 21, 23, 24, 26, 27, 29, 30, and 31. Why? 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 And when God finally comes to Job, he never answers his question. Instead, God asks Job about 100 questions. God asks Job puzzling questions, hard questions, which if you boiled all of God's questions down, the questions that God asks in the last four chapters of the book, if you boiled them all down, God's big question to Job in Job's suffering is this. This is the big question in suffering. You get ready. Here it is. Job, how awesome do you think I am? That's the question, the big question in our suffering. Do we fear God? How much do we revere God? How deeply do we revere God? The big question is not, why does God allow suffering? The big question is, how deeply does the one suffering fear God? How deeply do you trust God? How awesome is God in your view? Today what we're going to do is we're going to read the first two chapters. These are rounds 1 and 2 of Job's suffering. As I sometimes do, I'm going to take the largest portion of the message to actually just read the Bible with comment. And then I'm going to very quickly identify the main point and one application. Okay? So I'm going to read, identify the main point, and then make one application. Let's start reading in Job 1:1. The first five verses I would summarize as just saying Job fears God and is blessed. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. Of course, to fear God does not mean that you live always like shaking, like I can't do anything because I'm so afraid. It actually means that you have trembled before God. You've acknowledged the reality of his existence, and you have taken refuge in God, in the one way that he has provided for you to be forgiven and made right with him through the sacrifice that he's commanded. And now you live in a way that is respectful and trusting and obedient toward God, not perfectly, but genuinely and perseveringly. Fearing the Lord is the Old Testament way of saying you have a relationship with God. His reality has come to change and dominate your life. Job is a man who fears God. And verse 2 says, there were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. You would say he was like the Bill Gates of his day. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of all of his children. For Job said, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. In other words, he prayed for his children on a regular basis. What the narrator does in this first paragraph is he describes Job's greatness. Job is a man of godly character, and he's a man of remarkable prosperity, and he has a large, good family. You might say Job had it all. That's the point. Sometimes people doubt, actually, whether Job is nonfiction. Is this guy a historical character? But it's helpful to point out here, right at the outset of our study, that if you look at Ezekiel chapter 14, Ezekiel is going to say that Job, just like Noah and just like Daniel, are remarkable examples of prayer in Scripture. To Ezekiel, Job was as historical as Daniel and Noah. Job existed. And much more significantly and much more authoritatively, the Lord Jesus taught his own half-brother and one of his disciples, James, that Job was a powerful historical example that all Christians needed to follow. It's why James says in chapter 5, you've heard of the steadfastness of Job, you need to follow it. Further, when you piece together various facets of Job's life, like his practice of sacrificial worship every week, or that one of his friends we're going to see is a Temanite, or the kind of money he used, we'll actually see that detail in chapter 42, or things like the length of his life, he lived to about 140 years. If you piece all of those little historical details together, it presents a consistent match with the time of the patriarchs. Very likely, Job lived around the time of Joseph, around 1800 years B.C. Job is a real person. He lived in history, about 1800 B.C., and he is a powerful example for us. Coming out of this first paragraph, it's tough for me not to comment on its influence on me as a dad. Regularly praying, interceding to God for every one of my children by name. What a powerful and convicting example. The next paragraph then shifts from this remarkably godly man named Job to the throne room of God. Chapter 1, verses 6 through 12 is where Job is acclaimed by God and accused by Satan. Now there was a day when the sons of God, that's a reference to angels, came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among the angels. And the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? Satan answered, from going to and fro on the earth. He's evasive. From walking up and down on it. He's basically telling God, yeah, you don't really need to know. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him in all the earth? A blameless and upright man, he fears me, and he turns away from evil. Do you notice that God begins the conversation about Job? It's because God delights in Job that he brings up the conversation. This should bring a tear to our eyes. You know that God's proud of his servants? God delights in his people. God was proud of Job. He says, Satan, do you see this man? And of course, Satan is sly and evasive, and he is a cruel accuser. Verse 9, Satan says, oh yeah, does Job fear God for no reason? Haven't you put a hedge around him and all his house so that he has on every side this wall of protection? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in land. But I guarantee you, if you stretch out your hand and touch all he has, he's going to curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, okay, behold all he has. It's in your hand. Only you're not allowed to touch him. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Here, Satan accuses Job of selfishness. He is loving God only for God's blessings. And the Lord allows Satan to test Job to prove whether this accusation holds up. Notice that even though God gives Satan a degree of liberty, Satan is on God's leash. Martin Luther used to use belittling language to mock Satan. He would say he's God's devil. That's true. He's God's creature on God's leash. Satan has a degree of license, but God says, you go this far and no further. In verses 13 through 22, Job is then tested, and he is proven to fear God unselfishly, not for what he gets out of God. Verse 13, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. In other words, the first trial is violent marauders, a violent army, destroyed much of his property. And then the second word is that lightning ignited a wildfire in nature that destroyed more of your property. And those two things are going to happen again. Verse 17, while the second one was speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck them down. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. It fell upon the young people, and they're dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Again, this natural disaster hits, something like a tornado maybe, and it took the lives of Job's 10 children. And Job's response to these reports, including this last and most devastating report, is just remarkable. He stripped everything off of himself. He made himself naked to show that anything he has, including life itself, is more than what he deserves. And it is worth praising God for. Verse 20, Job arose and tore his robe. He shaved his head and he fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. But my life is still going to be all about worshiping the Lord. Through tears, he's worshiping the Lord. In grief and in numbness, he's saying, God, you're worthy of worship. In all this, verse 22 says, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Then we go to round two. Job, in verses 1 to 6 of chapter 2, is acclaimed by God again and accused by Satan again. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? And Satan gave the same evasive answer. Verse 3, the Lord says, have you considered my servant Job? He fears me. And God says, at the end of verse 3, he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, ah, skin for skin, all that a man has he'll give for a skin. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse you to your face, God. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand. Only spare his life. In other words, you can take his health, you just can't take his life. Chapter 2 begins almost as an exact repeat of chapter 1. Wording is almost identical. The one major difference is that the horrors of chapter 1 have already happened. Job has already learned when chapter 2 starts that his property has been destroyed and that his children are dead. In verse 3 of chapter 2, the Lord again speaks of his immense delight in Job. And yet Satan accuses Job of even deeper selfishness, saying he cares more about his own health than he cares about his children. You talk about a horrific accusation of selfishness. But this is where the test is. And so in verses 7 to 10, Job is again tested and proven to fear God unselfishly. Verse 7, so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. One pastor, Welsh pastor, Derek Thomas, suggests not only from this description, but if you put together all the descriptions of Job's physical issues in the whole book, he has symptoms like aching and peeling skin and wart-like eruptions, and he's unrecognizable by his friends. He's dealing with what appears to be anorexia and fever and sleeplessness and nightmares and failing vision. And Thomas suggests that he's probably struggling with something either like leprosy, or Thomas says more likely like elephantiasis, where you have massive swelling in various parts of your body that ends up breaking out in your skin. But Job's response to his wife is just remarkable. His wife says to him, verse 9, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Just curse God and die. Just give up. But he said to her, you're acting out of character. You're now speaking as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God? And shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. It's an incredible response. And before any of us act harshly toward Job's wife, I think we should consider that her response, rather than Job's, is much more likely what our response would be. It may be a bit more common among God's people in crisis when a trial hits that we think cynically, what has serving God got me? Look where serving God has landed me. It has led to nothing but hardship. I'm giving up on God. I guess that some of us may have even sounded like Job's wife this week. That's the trial. That's Job's proven fear of the Lord. And then chapter 2 ends with Job being supported in his grief by a few friends who keep silent. Verse 11, now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and to comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they didn't recognize him. And they raised their voices and they wept and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word. One of the things you might want to do if you want a crash course in how to minister people when they are dealing with grief is just underline the verbs in verses 11, 12, and 13. They came. They made an appointment. They saw him. They wept. They tore their robes. That's an act of empathy. They sat with him on the ground. They didn't speak a word. That's a crash course in how to minister to people who are grieving immediate loss. To comfort hurting friends, you should be alert. You should be responsive, empathetic. You should be present, giving your time and attention. And usually, you should be silent. Grief is not a time for attempting explanation. It's not a time to preach sermons. It's a time for silence. That's Job 1 and 2. You ready to go for the main point? The main point of these two chapters is profound. The main point is essentially this. God is worthy of your praise. Worthy of your praise and worthy of your life. Even when you lose everything. Even when He Himself has allowed everything to be taken from you. He's still worthy of your praise. He's worthy of your life. This is the message of these chapters. It's simple. It's profound. Do you realize that the central issue of Job 1 and 2 is how awesome God is? Job 1 verse 9, go back to it. Satan asks this accusational question. He says, does Job fear you for nothing? Notice in that question, Satan is not attacking Job nearly as much as he's attacking God. He is certainly questioning Job's motives, and he's basically implying that Job is selfish. God, he's just manipulating you. He's only loving you for what he gets out of you. So Satan is accusing Job. But do you notice that Satan is accusing God even much more significantly? God is at stake here in chapter 1 and chapter 2. Satan is essentially saying this about God. God, people don't really find you all that great. God, people will love and follow you, not because they like you, but because they like all the stuff you give them. They love you not for you, but for what they can get out of you. Do you see that Satan's cruel, horrible accusation, his insinuation? God, you're not worth following. You're not worth loving or fearing or trusting. Satan is attacking God. He's attacking whether God is worthy of our worship and our love and our fear and our trust. I need to say, I am not the only one who has understood that this is the main point. I criticized earlier that so many people kind of broad brush the book and I think get it wrongly. But many people have understood it rightly. Let me tell you about one named Joseph Carroll. He was a Puritan nonconformist around the time of John Owen. He pastored a church in London, actually a church right next to London Bridge, and the king kicked him out of his church in 1662. At that point, Joseph Carroll was in his 11th year preaching through the book of Job. I'm going to do it in about 8 weeks. He was in his 11th year, if you think that's funny. He would preach through the book for a total of 24 years. Preaching 424 sermons on it, which you can still get in a 10-volume set. I've not read them. I've read the summary of them. I give you that background so you will understand the significance of Joseph Carroll's statement about the main point of Job. And he gets it from Job chapters 1 and 2. Joseph Carroll said, "This book serves to combat the idea that God's people follow him for their own ends, selfishly. And to show that his people follow him for love, for the excellency they find in him and in his service. Though he strip them naked of all they have, yet they will cleave to him." God's people love him because they find him awesome. They find him better than life. So the big question that this book forces us to ask is this: how awesome is God to you? And how you respond in your suffering shows what you think about God. How you respond when you suffer shows whether you're ultimately living for the glory of God or whether what you're really living for is success and comfort and God's just your ticket of getting that or getting that to a better degree. You see, sufferings show whether we love God or whether we're just using God. So I said I would state the main point and then apply it in one way. That's what I'm doing. Every trial that comes into your life, this is application, every trial that comes into your life is controlled by God. And it is intended by God to give you an opportunity to do what you were created to do. That is glorify Him. We exist for God. It's not the other way around. God doesn't exist for us. We exist for Him. And your trials are an opportunity for you to glorify God. You can glorify God before onlooking people. You can glorify God, get this, before angels whom you've never seen but are making accusations in the throne room of God against you. And you can be showing angels by your response in trial that God is totally worth serving, even when He strips you of everything you have. When God takes away blessings in your life and you continue to love Him, you show everyone how awesome God is, that you serve Him for who He is and not for what you get out of Him. You glorify God, and that's what you were made to do. To put it very, very bluntly, this application, what could happen to you that would make you curse God? If there's anything that could make you say, God, I'm done with you, whether it's the loss of property or the loss of your children or the loss of your health, whatever it is that you answer that question with is your God. And if you're sitting here and you're all cheery in a church service this morning praising God, but you would curse Him if you lost property or children or health, it shows that God is just someone you're manipulating. You're just here because you have other gods and you think that worshiping God is your ticket to getting those things that you really treasure. None of these things are bad, like property or children or health. We should thank God for every one of them. We should pray to God for every one of them. But they are horrible. They will send you to hell if you live for them as gods. If you use the breath that God gives you to live for everything other than God, and God is just your ticket to the things that really matter to you, you who exist to glorify God are basically saying that everything else in the world except God is worth living for. And God is worth living for only because you love other things. None of these things are bad. But if you love them more than you love God, they are idols. If you view them as entitlements, something God owes you, He owes me success, He owes me children, He owes me health. Americans, we live in a world of entitlement. Give me what I deserve. Give me what I'm owed. Give me my rights. No. Job teaches us that we're entitled to nothing. Let me just point out again how Job responds. Chapter 1, he says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave and the Lord's taken away, but I'm going to worship the Lord." He presents us again with a model of how to respond to suffering in a way that's exactly opposite cursing God. In chapter 2, verse 10, when he looks at his wife and he says, "Should we accept only good things from the hand of God and never anything bad?" Job shows us how sufferings present us with an incredible opportunity to glorify God. That's why we breathe. We breathe to glorify God, and sufferings give us an opportunity to shout, God is worth living for. God is worth living for, even when He takes everything away. I want to end in a way that brings us back to the main point. We must remember that this book is not primarily saying, be like Job. Job is a powerful example, and he gives us a lot of things we can learn from. One thing I was meditating on earlier this week is just even the fact that I wonder if Job's constant prayer for his children, fearing that they might curse God in their hearts, and he's praying for his kids to live with hearts devoted to God, I wonder if just that habit in life, as he prayed the right way for his children, just cultivated within him this heart of living for God and not cursing God regardless of the blessings of the trials that come. There's a lot of things we could meditate on from the life of Job, but we must remember that the book of Job, just like the rest of the Old Testament, shows us how desperately we need Jesus, right? Job is a powerful example in suffering. But do you realize as humans, we need so much more than a good example of suffering? Our problems run much, much deeper than just needing a good example of how to suffer. We need a substitute. We need someone who can suffer in our place and for our sin. It was Jesus who was not merely our example in suffering, but our substitute in his suffering. His blood shed on Calvary made a way for sinners like us to be forgiven, for us to be cleansed of all of our arrogance and selfishness, our living for ourselves rather than God, all of our bitterness in suffering. You know, if you admit this morning, yeah, I need a good example in suffering because I'm so often prone to get bitter, either at others or at God, for the problems in my life. Who can deal with your bitterness? You need more than a good example. You need someone who can forgive you of your sin and of your arrogance and of your bitterness. If you're not a follower of Jesus, I urge you, much, 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 much more than be like Job. Submit your life to King Jesus. He died in your place so that you could be forgiven by God and you could have a relationship with God. Jesus rose again. He's coming again. I urge you to submit to him before it's too late. If you are a follower of Jesus, I urge you, much, much more than be like Job, I urge you to keep looking to Jesus who suffered in your place and who suffered as your remarkable example. Think of those words which Jesus prayed the night before he was crucified. Father, here's what I want, yet not my will, but yours be done. In that one prayer, Jesus magnified the worth of his Father because he said, Father, you're worth more to me than life. What an opportunity sufferings give us for glorifying God.